Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, October 10th, 2024. Beauty in all its strange configurations. The life of James McGee. The Big Bend remembers creator of enigmatic Hudspeth County masterwork. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas. Memorials to James McGee, sculptor, painter, poet, welder, lawyer, roughneck, hitchhiker, visionary, and friend to many, have rippled across the art world since September 14th, when he passed away at the age of 79 in his hometown of Fremont, Michigan. He is survived by his sisters, Susan Winte and Barbara Kimball, and his partner, Camilla Carr. Among his many achievements, McGee is perhaps best known for The Hill, an indescribable work of sculpture and space he spent more than half of his life creating on an anonymous mesa in Hudspeth County. McGee loved Marfa, and Marfa loved McGee. He always wanted to come here more than he was able to get here, said Carolyn Pfeiffer, one of many Big Bend locals who were personally touched by his work and indefatigable spirit. He had this extraordinarily positive personality, she remembered. When you came into contact with it, you were infected. Writer Sterry Butcher wrote a piece on McGee for Texas Monthly in 2020, and they kept in sporadic touch after that. McGee was unlike any artist she'd ever known. She compared him to the pronghorn, a misnamed West Texas creature, more closely related to the giraffe than any kind of antelope. He was way off on his own evolutionary branch, she said. A merry-go-round of too much. Though he made his home and studio in El Paso, McGee belonged to the borderlands writ large, to the Juarez queer scene, to the vast nothing of central New Mexico, to green chili cheeseburgers at May's Cafe in Cornutas, Texas. He came to Far West Texas by accident, literally after a train derailment in Sinaloa left him stranded after a visit to Mexico City. He decided to try to get to El Paso and from there to his then home in New York. He took the train through Chihuahua, through the Copper Canyon country in the capital city, which charmed him, and ended up in the conjoined border cities that would later become the center of his universe. McGee's early biography is a runaway train of its own, and trying to describe his life in a straightforward timeline is a fool's errand. An attempt, culled from an oral history conducted by the Smithsonian. He was born on June 3, 1945, in Fremont, Michigan, whose only claim to fame is the Gerber Baby Food Factory. He picked up drawing very young, but he had difficulty reading and was self-described really, really, really dyslexic. Despite that, he had a fondness for words. He had wildly diverse interests and had trouble between pursuing a 5-year PhD in African art and attending law school. He eventually picked law school and later worked for the United Nations on protections for conscientious objectors to the Vietnam War. He was very well traveled, inspired by French monks and Irish revolutionaries and boatmen from Mali. After law school, he settled down in a junkyard on Staten Island in a warehouse turned studio. He started writing poetry and making sculpture. Eventually, he turned his sights upstate and purchased an underwear factory-turned-chicken coop to begin producing work on a bigger scale. He worked part-time at a home for adults with developmental disabilities and caring for an elderly man in the city. He ate a lot of pancakes and crafted a sculpture called The Rapture, made from hundreds of Mrs. Butterworth bottles. During the oil boom of 1979, McGee came to Texas seeking work on rigs outside of Odessa, temporarily abandoning his search back in New York for an isolated place to start acquiring land for a large-scale project. His time in the oil fields started getting his West Texas gears turning. When he returned home and found that his rented cabin had been struck by lightning, he took it as a sign to permanently relocate. His other life in the city had been wearing him thin. "That was my cycle, which was absolutely insane," he remembered. "You know, UN, home for the dying, gay bar, sex club, gay bar. Then by 1 or 2 in the morning, St. Mark's baths, and then home to bed. Then wake up with 6 hours of sleep and go to the UN." The following year, he settled down for good in El Paso. "I could not keep this up," he said. "Texas was there, and I knew it might be able to save me from a merry-go-round of too much." Journey of Death as Seen Through the Eyes of the Rancher's Wife. McGee did not go to El Paso alone. Annabelle Livermore, a retired librarian from the Upper Midwest, came too, setting up a studio near his home and settling into the local art scene. By some metrics, Livermore was more successful than McGee. For one, she has her own museum, championed by dealer and gallerist Adair Margot. She put up major shows at Yale and the San Diego Museum of Art and was invited to paint a hospital chapel. First Lady Laura Bush was a fan and collector. But unlike McGee, with his intricate network of friends from around the world, Livermore was content to live her life privately. "Very few people claim to have met Miss Livermore," wrote Edward Lucy Smith. "She never attends her own exhibition openings, but sometimes sends tape-recorded good wishes, uttered in a quavering voice." It did not take long for the art world to discover that McGee and Livermore were the same person. It was immediately clear to his close friends that Livermore was not a delusion, nor a sign that McGee wanted to swap his identity for a female one. McGee himself was adamant that she was something more than a name. As a man in his 20s, McGee occasionally released work under the name J.R. McCoy, hoping to avoid attention. "It was, I think, out of some kind of embarrassment as to who I was and what I was. And my family was just heartbroken, except for my younger sister, of my having done this life that I had chosen, both the gay thing and the art thing," he remembered in the same oral history tape for the Smithsonian. Annabelle Livermore was different. Some would use terms like alter ego or persona, but perhaps she was a portal, a way to access another part of his creativity and, by extension, himself. "It's not a pseudonym," he insisted. "This is a friend of mine who's had decades of my life, and we're trying to do the best that we can." Much of McGee's sculpture work is industrial, drawing on his time in the trades, on his skills as a welder and a builder. Among his earliest pieces were disturbingly contorted crosses and semi-humans with animal teeth smashed into the ground. Befitting a demure Midwestern librarian, Livermore's work could be described as softer, depicting animals and trees and tranquil bodies of water. She was deeply inspired by the Big Bend, creating a series of paintings interpreting scenes along the famous River Road. Attorney Liz Rogers of Alpine owns a Livermore, which she hung in her kitchen. She got to know McGee and his then-partner, Rod McCall, in the early 1980s when she began practicing law in El Paso. She saw the painting and had to have it, even though it was wildly out of budget. "I had to reach deep, deep in my pockets," she said, "but I've loved it ever since." Rogers was drawn to Livermore's work for the same reason many other borderlanders do. It's playful, but it feels honest. "She has really touched people's heartstrings here," Margot wrote. "She has processed the border region in a very unselfconscious way. People look at it and say, 'This is who we are. We love this work.'" In the spring of 2001, McGee took Livermore to a ranch in New Mexico where she could paint uninterrupted for 4.5 weeks. The closest town was Truth or Consequences, 40 miles away. The ranch was smack dab in the middle of the Jornada del Muerto, the Journey of Death, a waterless 90-mile route from Socorro to Las Cruces that early settlers would often cross in the middle of the night to avoid the heat. Hundreds of years later, the Americans considered it just as unfit for human habitation as the Spanish, and used it to test nuclear bombs. Livermore was taken by Laverne Walker, whose husband owned the property. She was fascinated by how Walker had made a life in such a remote and an inhospitable place, and named the series of paintings Journey of Death as seen through the eyes of the rancher's wife. Like much of Livermore's work, the paintings are not straightforward landscapes. They're not photorealistic. All of the rancher's wife paintings have a warm, fiery palette of reds and oranges and yellows. Some of them are anchored to the canvas by a tiny ridge of mountains at the bottom. The rest of the expansive 6x4-foot frame is presumably sky, busy with brush strokes that evoke clouds, storms, wind, and mysterious forms. The name of the series was just as much a part of the work as the paint itself. If a woman regularly drives 40 miles to get a loaf of bread, she'll think a lot about death, Livermore wrote. Before and after the hill. 100-odd miles away from the ranch, another important work was rooting itself in the land, this time outside of Cornudas, Texas. Located between El Paso and Del City, Cornudas is more of a collection of buildings than a town. The 2000 census estimated a population of 19 people. The only business is the Cornudas Cafe, formerly known as May's, after outspoken former proprietor May Carson. Carson passed away in 2018. But the cafe still receives a few visitors each year looking for the hill. She would later tell an interviewer that some folks in the area suspected McGee was a devil worshiper, but by most accounts, they had a warm relationship. "If you can live in Cornudas, you are something," said McGee's friend, Judith Gaskin. Maybe people there thought he was weird, but they respected him. In 1981, McGee started buying up land in Cornudas for a project he'd been envisioning, in one shape or another, his entire adult life. He started with 100 acres and gradually worked his way up to 2,000 to begin a work he called The Hill, made of four structures that are 40 feet long, 20 feet wide, and 17 feet high. McGee surveyed the place by hand, setting out with a string and compass to mark where the structures would one day be built. There were never any blueprints, no architect. The rock work was done by hand. Massive sculpted panels and intricate floor pieces were assembled and welded by McGee himself. Over the past four decades, The Hill has formed a sort of cult following, unknown to most, but feverishly evangelized by the few who know it. The Hill was not originally conceived as a work of art, nor should it be thought of as merely a configuration of four buildings holding artwork within, McGee wrote. Instead, the hill in its entirety, as I believe it to be, is one single sculpture or spiritual ornament laid out in the form of a cross and configured with doors opening up into doors opening up into doors opening up into doors. Very few people have ever seen the hill, which has traditionally cost a few hundred dollars, payable to the Cornutus Mountain Foundation, to visit. This was not an act of exclusionary art world cool kid snobbery. It costs the foundation around $2,000 per viewing to operate the hill. First, there's the long drive from El Paso and the renting of a four-wheel drive vehicle. Then the hill has a lot of heavy moving parts that need to be operated by a team of workers. The third building typically requires four people to open it. A key facet of the experience itself is McGee, who wrote long titles for each work, works in their own right that others might describe as poems. He would accompany each small group and read the titles as they processed the immensity of the work. The total effect is impossible for the few who have seen it to describe. It has been called startling and sacred. A common response to the work is for viewers to burst into tears. "The art defies description," wrote Bob Ostertag. "Giant works of many tons each. Steel and iron triptychs on huge ball bearings. Studies in rust and decay and debris, acid and honey, beeswax and burnt rubber, paprika and cold rolled steel, barbed wire and pig bone. Going to the hill is not like going to view art," he continued, "but going not only into the dreams and the imagination, but also the bones, blood, and muscle of James McGee." Art historian Richard Brettel put it in simpler terms. "Anyone who has visited the hill divides his or her life into two new parts, before and after the hill." While the hill does not involve the land in the same way that works of the Southwestern Land Art Pantheon do, McGee was always concerned about maintaining some of that sacredness. Despite Cornuda's isolation, he started to notice land developing in the background. Just before his death, a pair of oil rigs popped up in the horizon. Thankfully, they disappeared. He started constructing a series of columns to encircle the work, creating a sense of protection without closing it off from the outside world. "It doesn't deny what is happening on the other side," he said. "I think that would be kind of wrong, to hide a place from what is happening on the other side." After the hill, McGee understood that there would soon come a day where he could no longer oversee his masterwork. In 2022, he filled a large binder with his will and vision. Eric Pearson, president of the El Paso Community Foundation, also serves on the Cornutus Mountain Foundation board. The two foundations joined forces to provide a blueprint for the hill's preservation. "Everyone agrees that the goal is to sustain the hill into perpetuity," Gaskin, who also serves on the board, said. In the short term, this arrangement allows McGee's assistant, Juan Munoz of El Paso, to continue working. "He was always amazed by Juan," Gaskin said. A celebration of McGee's life is tentatively set for the first week of May 2025 at the Hill. While access to the Hill and the Museo Livermore might be limited until then, there are a few ways to sit with the work. Butcher, who spent so much time trying to put his life into words, recommends visiting the meditation room at the University Medical Center of El Paso, which was designed by Annabelle Livermore. The space features a cosmic overhead painting and a series of smaller paintings on hinges, which visitors can open and leave a prayer for a loved one. Everything you need to know about the artist is in that space, I think, and its elements echo what is at the hill, she said. Wisdom, beauty, a certain whimsy, tenderness, mystery. What more could express love than to create a place of solace and communion? McGee was just as unable to describe the sanctity and inwardness of his work, but he did try. Art for me is some kind of a meditation, and that is a very private act, he said. It has nothing to do with showbiz or anything else. That's how I see it. It's the taking in of beauty, you know, in all its strange configurations. Photo, courtesy of Cornutus Mountain Foundation. A portrait of James McGee by San Elizario artist Gaspar Enriquez. Photo, courtesy the artist Galeri Gisela Capitain and Hauser and Worth. Zoe Leonard, Al Rio, /To the River. Detail, gelatin silver prints, sea prints, and inkjet prints, 2016 to 2022. Copyright, Zoe Leonard. Women sue the state over lack of abortion access in new documentary. Swarovski vs. Texas, directed by Maisie Crowe and Abby Perot, screens locally. By Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Texas. The lives of three women traumatized by Texas abortion laws following the reversal of Roe v. Wade and their pursuit of justice is the focus of Swarovski v. Texas, a new documentary by directors Maisie Crowe and Abby Perot. The film, which premiered at the Telluride Film Festival earlier this fall, will be shown at 5 p.m. Sunday, October 13th, at the Marfa Public Library Community Room, and at 6 p.m. Monday, October 14th, at the Sol Ross Gallego Center Room, the Fishbowl. Crow will present for Q&As at each screening. Having previously collaborated on Jackson, a 2018 film about the right to access reproductive health care in Mississippi, Crow and Perot, editor-in-chief of the Big Bend Sentinel and previous managing editor, respectively, said they began pursuing another film when Roe was overturned in 2022. We've had an idea to make a film about what's happening with abortion in America since Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization got taken up to the Supreme Court, and we've just been looking for the right story to tell, Perot said. The directors didn't immediately decide to focus on the Swarovski v. Texas case, they said, but after encountering nothing but devastation during the field research, were drawn to the Center of Reproductive Rights lawyer Molly Duane, the lead attorney on the case and a main character in the film, for the level of hope her and her clients brought to the situation. It was the first time that we felt like, okay, there is hope. Someone is doing something. There is potential for these laws to change, Crow said. The case marks the first time women testified on their own behalf in a court of law for access to abortion since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. The director said they were further compelled by the personal stories of the women speaking out. Lead plaintiff Amanda Swarovski, as well as plaintiffs Samantha Casiano and Dr. Austin Dinard, all who needed abortions for medical reasons for which they were denied. We felt like these are all very brave, very strong individuals who were willing to put their names out there, as many of them say, to protect other women, Rose said. They are choosing to put their faces to this case when abortion has continued to be stigmatized, Perot added. Crowe and Perot began filming in March 2023, following not only court proceedings. One of the documentary's pivotal scenes is when women take to the stand to testify during Texas Supreme Court arguments in November 2023, but also the emotional turmoil the women and their families were experiencing as the result of child loss. We wanted to show that abortion is health care and that it's not just a women's issue, that this is about families at its core, Perot said. This film shows that access to abortion is about being able to determine the future for your family. It impacts so many more people than just the woman herself. Zarosky, particularly, wanted the film to show the many ways being denied abortion care still impacts her life, something mainstream media stories didn't dig into, Perot said. To us, it was really important to show that this wasn't just an acute moment, but something that lasts, she said. Noticeably absent during a Texas Supreme Court hearing scene are the names of the state's attorneys questioning the women. Due to a judge's restrictions, filmmakers were only permitted to have one camera on a tripod in the room and could not zoom or pan. Crow said they chose to position the camera towards the women testifying and to not name the attorneys because they felt like they were the embodiment of the state itself. We constantly wanted to remind viewers, this is the state of Texas that is saying this. This is the state of Texas that thinks that these laws are okay the way they are, Crow said. In keeping with that thinking, the directors chose not to interview the Attorney General's office or include input from the other side, allowing their legal actions in the case to speak for themselves, Crow said. Our perspective was that the other side was playing out in these laws, in the questioning in the courtroom, the responses when the AG's office appealed, the medical board hearing, Crow said. We felt like they were telling their story that way, and what we wanted to tell was the stories of those being affected by these laws. Crow said health care, bodily autonomy, and personal freedoms were top of mind during the filming and editing of the project. Those themes are resonating with audiences where the film has screened, she said, often with women who shared similar experiences with the plaintiffs, but live in states where abortion laws are less restrictive than in Texas. They were able to get care, and they found it so alarming that those same experiences they had had in this country, when Roe was the law of the land, they were shocked that now people can't get care. Crow said. I think for a lot of people, they had never considered something like what Zarosky went through and as needing an abortion. They didn't associate that with abortion, but it is abortion. Crow began filming Zarosky v. Texas shortly after giving birth to her own son. She said having experienced a traumatic birth herself gave her a personal understanding of how emotional and dangerous being pregnant can be, she said, which she carried with her throughout the filming process. Zarosky v. Texas will screen at nearly 20 film festivals this month, and impact screenings are planned in ballot initiative and swing states across the country. We feel like it's a really great educational tool for voters to understand what abortion bans mean in practice, Crow said. Jennifer Lawrence and Hillary Clinton are both executive producers on the film. Both Hillary and Chelsea Clinton, a professor of public health, have participated in panels on the documentary. We're very grateful that they were willing to use their platform to elevate the stories of the women in this film, Rose said. For more information, visit ZarowskyVTexas.com. ZarowskyVTexas.com. After Roe Productions, LLC. scene from Zorosky v. Texas, directed by Maisie Crow and Abby Perot.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan Snooze for Thursday, September 26th. Snake anti-venom. Does our hospital carry it, and how much does it cost? The story was written by Jan Cranfill. Recently, reports of snake sightings in several local neighborhoods and in and around Parkway Elementary have become a cause for concern, as well as raising the question about anti-venom treatment and cost. City of Monahan's Animal Control Officer Joe Alvera told the news there has been an increase in rattlesnake sightings this year compared to last year. Quote, "There's more rattlesnakes being reported this year than last year. Last week, we received a call to the north side from a man who was weed-eating around his house and found a mama and babies. I wasn't there, but was told the initial report was about a 6 to 8 foot mama and possibly 8 1-foot long babies. Only one baby was found," Olvera said. According to Ward Memorial Hospital Chief Nursing Officer Ian Ray, Ward Memorial Hospital keeps 2 rounds of anti-venom for snake bites on hand. The prescribed treatment is a series of 6 injections of Crofab anti-venom. Quote, "We have treated 2 bite victims this year, one last April and one last May," he said. Crofab is an approved serum made from the venom of 4 North American pit vipers, including the cottonmouth, water moccasin, Mojave rattlesnake, eastern diamondback, and western diamondback. The venom is created by envenomating Australian sheep with the venom of the 4 snakes, which will produce specific antibodies in the sheep blood that will fight against the toxins. The goal of the anti-venom administration is to stop progression of soft tissue swelling and improve coagulation. The Crofab used at Ward Memorial Hospital is freeze-dried and reconstituted with a saline solution. The serum must be used within a 4-hour window or it becomes unusable. The Crofab in freeze-dried form is shelf-stable for 18 to 24 months. The treatment is 6 vials of serum if started within 1 hour of the bite. Once initial control is achieved, an additional 2 vials are given every 6 hours until 6 vials have been administered. If the bite is not treated within the first hour, an additional 4 to 6 vials may be necessary. Tissue damage increases with the amount of time between the bite and the treatment. Severe tissue damage can result in loss of affected limb or body part. The cost of the 6-vial treatment at Ward Memorial Hospital is $9,400, with no guarantee insurance will cover the cost. Cost at other hospitals can be over $19,000 for the series of treatments. Quote, "It's a very iffy situation with the insurance companies. Some will not cover the cost at all. People need to check with their companies and find out if their policy has that coverage," Ray said. If a snake bite occurs, the person needs to be as aware as possible as to the kind of snake that is involved in the incident, because medical personnel will ask what kind of snake was involved. Serums are created to be effective for specific species of snakes. The Crofab used here is specifically used for the cottonmouth water moccasin, eastern and western diamondbacks, whereas a different type of serum is needed for copperheads, coral snakes, etc. Residents should practice caution when near piles of trash, like in some of the city alleys, and in parks that border any undeveloped land. in your yard, keep weeds and grass cut down and trash piles cleaned up. Children should be taught not to touch a snake. Call an adult when one is seen. According to Olvera, quote, winter is coming and the snakes are starting to seek warm places to spend the winter, like under houses, end quote. Be cautious, be aware, you may not hear the hiss of their rattle, and when they rattle, you are too close for safety. Commissioners approved $2.5 million for a ballpark. Renovation plans begin for senior center. Power plant abatement approved. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. During the Monday morning meeting of the Ward County Commissioners, Ward County Judge Greg Holly presented the bid summary for the completion of the ballpark complex. The ballpark project is in its final phase, which is the completion of two more fields, an adult field, a pony league field, the electrical for the T-ball field, two more concession stands, restrooms, a press box, concrete walks to tie all the fields together, and more asphalt for the parking area. When finished, the whole complex will be American with Disabilities Act compliant. The bid summary for Phase 2 includes concrete, $345,000, steel, $478,000, masonry, $247,000, electrical, $704,000, bleachers, $133,000, asphalt, $500,000, fencing, $500,000, picnic table, $20,000, sod, $10,000, all coming to a total of $2,545,000. Quote, this project would have cost $12 to $15 million if it had been completely contracted out, but my crew and I did a lot of the work ourselves and will finish the whole project for $8.25 million, Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelm said. During the past few years of building and remodeling of county facilities, it has long been a plan to relocate the senior center to the former Ward County Community Center, which is attached to the county library. In Monday's session, the commissioners approved the potential hiring of Kenny Burns, the architect who designed the new Ward County law enforcement facility and many other jails, senior centers, and public buildings throughout the state. Quote, since the requirements stipulate choices must be made on demonstrated competence and qualifications, I would like to submit the name of Kenny Burns as the architect for the project, as well as the five people who will make up the overseeing committee. Those five are myself, Larry Hanna, Clay Gardner, Carly Ennis, and Senior Center Director Lena Calixto, Holly said. The commissioners gave their approval on the choice of Kenny Burns for architectural services for the senior center. Also at Monday's meeting, the commissioners gave final approval on the tax abatement agreement with CPV Basin Ranch Energy Center for the building of a new power plant near Barstow. The tax abatement agreement is a 10-year tax break, with CPV agreeing to a 40% county tax rate for a 10-year period. The CPV spokesmen were at the August 12th commissioners meeting to introduce their plan for the power plant and told the commissioners, quote, we are looking at this area because of the natural gas availability. The plant would require large amounts of natural gas to power the turbines. To put the daily projected 1,350 megawatt hours into perspective, that amount would power 850,000 Texas homes, manager-developer Tom Rollo said. The tax abatement agreement with Ward County was a solid first step and working with Ward County to build the super plant approximately 6 miles northeast of Barstow on a 327-acre plot of land. Quote, Competitive Power Ventures, or CPV, is excited to be working in partnership with Ward County on the CPV Basin Ranch Energy Center to help meet the growing demand for electricity in Texas and the region, said Peter Podrigal, president of CPV Low Carbon Generation. Quote, Approval of the tax abatement is a critical step in advancing the project, and we deeply appreciate the support of the county and the community. We look forward to delivering the local economic impact of the CPV Basin Ranch Energy Center to Ward County and the region, and to playing a vital role in ensuring Texas has an ample and reliable energy supply, he added. CPV Director of Energy Transition Development, Robert Trotta, said, quote, We hope to start construction in mid-2025, barring any planning complications, end quote. In other agenda item discussions, the Air Medcare contract was given approval to be renewed at the new membership rates for $70 for 1 year, $180 for 3 years, $270 for 5 years, and $535 for a 10-year membership. The commissioners also approved the deputation and oath of office of Joshua Ryan Crawford to the sheriff's office. In regular business, the commissioners approved the last meeting's minutes, budget amendments for the county and hospital, officers' monthly reports, the hospital financial report, the treasurer's report, and gave approval to pay the county bills. Present for the Monday morning meeting were Precinct 1 Commissioner Tino Sanchez, Precinct 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna, Precinct 3 Commissioner Dexter Nichols, Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms, and Ward County Judge Greg Holly. The next regularly scheduled commissioners meeting will be held at 9:30 a.m. Tuesday, October 15th, at the Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen. Individuals who would like to address the court to ask questions or inform the commissioners of problems in their precinct or Ward County can call Judge Greg Holly at 432-943-3209, discuss their question or concern, and ask to be placed on the agenda for the next commissioners' meeting. Barstow Zombie Well, flowing 1,250 barrels per hour. The story was written by Smokey Briggs. Contractors hired by the Texas Railroad Commission are still battling to control an orphan oil well just north of Barstow that began flowing toxic water to the surface on September 1st. The leak was discovered by a local farmer, and there was no indication on the surface that a well had been drilled in the past. According to Railroad Commission spokesman Patty Roman, as of last week, the commission was still trying to find the actual well bore, while the flow from the well is estimated to be 1,250 barrels per hour. Quote, We are in the process of identifying the well bore. The agency has been utilizing pits, tanks, and water hauling trucks to contain the flow, after which plugging operations will begin, Ramon said. The Barstow eruption is the latest in a series of abandoned wells in the Permian Basin suddenly coming back to unwelcome life and bringing produced water to the surface instead of oil. Produced water is the byproduct of oil and gas operations and generally saturated with salts and chemicals incompatible with life. In the Permian Basin, an average of 5 barrels of such toxic water is produced for every barrel of oil. Most of the stuff is disposed of by injecting it back into the ground. For years, most was injected into deep formations, but over the past years that practice was associated with unwelcome and very noticeable seismic activity, with 4 of the 5 most powerful earthquakes in Texas history shaking the ground in the past few years. In response, the Railroad Commission shifted injection disposal from deep formations to shallower formations. Shortly thereafter, old oil wells started belching the stuff back to the surface. The first so-called zombie well, covered within this publication, was a 200-foot geyser in western Crane County that sprang to life on January 1, 2022. Since then, the rebirth of such zombie wells has marched westward from western Crane through Ward and Pecos counties, with the Barstow well only a few miles from the Ward-Reeves County line. While the 3 elected railroad commissioners, Christy Craddock, Wayne Christian, and Jim Wright, have all denied that there is any relationship between produced water disposal and orphan wells bringing that water to surface, the timeline between the shift to shallow injection and the appearance of leaking wells is a good match, and no other explanations have been offered by anyone. Meanwhile, while the produced water flowing to the surface is a serious problem, as the water kills everything it touches, a greater danger lurks subsurface. According to well control specialist and Railroad Commission candidate Hawk Dunlap, quote, "All of these wells act as potential pathways to bring the pressurized produced water to surface if the wells are not plugged or if old plugs give way. Worse," he said, "all of these wells also pierce the freshwater aquifers West Texas depend on for drinking water. The best scenario, in the case of a failed plug, is that the produced water comes to surface. The worst case is that the well casing has failed in one of the freshwater zones and the toxic brew is being forced into the aquifer," he said. City Council approves tax rate. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Meeting in regular session Tuesday afternoon, Monahan City Council approved the second and final reading of the property tax rate ordinance for the 2024 tax year. Council approved the ad valorem tax rate, and it will remain at 35 cents per $100 of valuation, the same as last year. City Manager Rex Thies said, quote, "Even though the city is not increasing the rate, the higher property values will mean the city will collect $160,000 or 7.4% more in tax revenue than last year, which constitutes a tax increase by state statute." The assessed valuation, according to the published budget, is $594 million, up from $513 million last year. The tax rate will produce an estimated tax levy of $2.07 million. Councilmen present were Calvin Carroll, Richard Hawkins, Jeppy Wilson, Gerald Stava, and Ivy Valenzuela. Mayor Adam Steen and City Attorney Justin Till were also present. In other business, the council also opened seal bids for the coming fiscal year fuel purchases. The city received 4 sealed bids from 3L USA, Southwest Marketers, Sun Coastal, and Hampel Oil. Thie read the bids aloud, with the bid from 3L USA for 27.5 cents per gallon over rack price for unleaded 91.87 and diesel 2 street use and 75 cents diesel 2 died off-road. The rack price was the price the dealer paid for the fuel. Southwest Marketers' bid came in at 24 cents per gallon over rack price across the board. Sun Coastal bid was 20.96 cents per gallon over rack price for the unleaded 91, 87, and diesel 2 street use, and 54.9 cent diesel 2 dyed off-road. And finally, ample oil bid was 30 cents per gallon over rack price across the board. They asked the council for more time to review the bids due to two of them having much higher cost on the diesel 2 dyed off-road. Quote, the diesel 2 dyed off-road is used mostly in the landfill and for our larger equipment, so I would like to look at the amounts used and cost of each one, he said. In routine matters, the council approved Resolution 2024-032 Code Enforcement Officer's Report regarding properties in violation of city code for either trash or weeds, items in the alleyway, and/or dangerous structures. The properties have all been given a first notice and did not comply, so this will allow code enforcement to follow up with a final notice and possibly move forward with court action if needed. Those reported to be still in violation are 409 South Allen, owned by Isaac and Belinda Diaz, 715 North Betty, owned by Porfirio Perez, 606 South James, owned by James Nolke, 807 South Bruce, owned by Crystal Barrera, and 602 South James, owned by Ronnie and Patricia Tone. Code enforcement will now follow up with a second notice to the property owners, asking them to bring their properties back up to code. Non-compliant cases may be sent to municipal court for further action. The remainder of the meeting entailed the council approving a warranty deed from Monahans Economic Development Corporation, which is where the Monahans Municipal Court will be located, 1216 South Seeley, and approved deeding 618 and 700 South Alice properties to the MEDC. The council also acknowledged the MEDC annual report presented by Director Ashley Adalto. The report detailed MEDC sales tax receipts from 2012 until present, the completion of clearing of the lot at 1200 South Stockton, the water, sewer, and paving plan for Block 26, Monahans Parkway Flume Revision, Block 25 Survey, Engineer and Design, the purchase of 719 and 721 South Main for commercial development, Block 27 listed for sale, the completion of the fitness court, the continued work with the retail coach, and the mural project. The accounts payables and monthly department reports from the airport manager, MEDC minutes and financials, building inspector, animal control, municipal court, and the Chamber of Commerce Hotel Motel Occupancy Report were all approved. Minutes of the September 10th meeting were also approved. Council members convened an executive session at the end of the meeting to discuss a settlement with Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. After reconvening into regular session, Thee said council members voted to appoint Thee to accept the $20,000 settlement with Southwestern Bell Telephone for damage caused to a fiber line by a city equipment in 2017. The council meets every second and fourth Tuesday of the month at 3 p.m. Anyone wanting to address the city council on the topics addressed in this story or any other topic may do so by asking to be added to the meeting agenda in the city secretary's office located inside City Hall, or by appearing at the meeting during the public comment section of the meeting, which is on every agenda. The next city council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, October 8th, in the council chambers at City Hall, 112 West 2nd Street. Hicks held on $50,000 bond after threatening judge. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man is currently being held in the Ward County Jail on a $50,000 bond after he allegedly made verbal threats to a local magistrate judge last weekend. Stephen Sean Hicks, age 54, of 707 West 8th Street, was in custody at the jail on a public intoxication charge from the previous night when the threats occurred. Deputies were called back to the sheriff's office in reference to the verbal threats on Sunday, September 15th, around 10:45 a.m. According to Ward County Sheriff's Office Chief Deputy Rudy Azuna, quote, Justice of the Peace Roy Bean was in the sheriff's office to Magistrate Hicks on a public intoxication charge. Judge Bean told deputies, while he was being read his legal warnings, Hicks made multiple threats. Although it wasn't clear of the exact threats made, Ozuna said Hicks made threats to have Judge Bean harmed. A warrant was obtained for Hicks, and he was subsequently charged with terroristic threat against peace officer Judge, a state jail felony.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.